Hebrews 13, verses 9 through 16. Do not be led away by diverse and strange teachings, for it is good for the heart to be strengthened by grace, not by food, which have no benefit to those who are devoted to them. We have an altar from which those who serve the tent have no right to eat. For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy places by the high priest as a sacrifice for sin are burned outside the camp. So Jesus also suffered outside the gate in order to sanctify the people through his own blood. Therefore, let us go to him outside the camp and bear the reproach that he endured. For here we have no lasting city, but we seek the city that is to come. Through him, then, let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God, that is, the fruit of lips that acknowledge his name. I do not neglect to do good and to share what you have, for such sacrifices are pleasing to God. The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. Prophet Jeremiah gives a really tangible picture, word picture, right in our face. And he's accusing Israel of something almost absurd. This comes from Jeremiah 2:13. Here's the picture. He says, "For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and they've hewed out cisterns for themselves, broken cisterns that can hold no water." It's a picture of spiritual insanity. God offers his people a fountain. It's living. It's fresh. It's endlessly sufficient. And what do? They turn away from it, and they begin to dig holes in the dirt. They build containers so that they can, you know, perhaps carry the water around with them. Perhaps it's safer that way. It feels a little bit more controllable. Perhaps they fear the fountain may one day run dry. But the tragedy is this. Those cisterns can't hold what they were intended to carry. They leak. So God's people keep pouring water back in, and then they watch it drain out. And they feel what? They feel anxious. They feel restless. And instead of questioning the cistern, they simply dig harder. Dig more, try again. And that particular word picture, that image, is going to be a bit of a guiding north star for this text. This text, too, is about restless hearts. Hearts that are trying to steady themselves by something that's visible, perhaps tangible or measurable, things that you can manipulate and control. And we too, Hebrews is preaching to us that we discover it's a leaking cistern. It doesn't work. Hebrews offers a simple but confronting truth. Restless hearts are only stabilized when Christ alone is our altar, our righteousness, and our confidence before God. It raises a few uncomfortable questions. What am I using to steady my heart instead of God's grace? Why am I continually drawn to things that promise a sense of spiritual security but leave me feeling somewhat anxious? If I keep drifting, is it because I do not find Christ truly satisfying? What am I missing? What am I not seeing about God's grace? John Calvin, sort of in writing in the Institutes, he describes the human heart as an idol factory. It constantly manufactures these little replacements. It's a perennial daily temptation in its our allegiance to God. Even mature believers, we wrestle with this reality all the time. We do not drift into faithfulness. We drift into substitutes. The question of this text is, how do you establish your heart? I mean, how do you really just grow in firm heart stability? Hebrews doesn't answer with techniques. What you want is something tangible and palpable and hold on to, a cistern, controllable. It answers with a person. Look with me at the subtle danger of an unstable heart. Hebrews warns in verse 9, do not be led away by diverse and strange teaching. So that warning does refer to obvious things, cults and obvious heresies, but the danger can also be, and the example that's given in this text, a lot more subtle. The audience of Hebrews was tempted to supplant Christ, not to replace him outright, not to reinforce him with old religious systems. They wanted a supplemental to Christ. They wanted a supplement to Christ, something to add to him. They were particularly tempted by food laws, dietary practices that were tied to their spiritual confidence. So Hebrews responds in verse 9, it is good for the heart to be strengthened by grace, not by foods, which have not benefited those who are devoted to them. Food, for this context of people, promised structure, promises control. It's a visible marker of your righteousness, your purity, but it never strengthened the heart. The same temptation is alive for us today. Many such temptations, strange and diverse teachings. It means that they're all over the place, these kinds of things. We too build modern cisterns. They too leave us anxious. They don't always look religious on the surface, but they function the same way spiritually. Things that promise us a bit of safety or can give to us a little bit of moral reassurance. They give us something tangible to hold. Think of a couple of those with you out loud. Some of us steady ourselves through what we do, our performance. So we build moral systems that promise that sense of security. We lean on spiritual routines to reassure ourselves. So consider, let's just take the food example and apply it maybe how we would use it. So let's say it's not food that came from a religious temple and you're not trying to find some religious significance there. You're just a Christian. But you think about food in a little bit. This is how subtle this category goes. Let's say you just choose healthier options. Okay? Choosing healthy food. That can be wise. Great. It's often more expensive. You know that. You own it. But here's where it gets us. The language slowly shifts. It becomes more than this is better choice. And subtly, something happens in our mind and when we partake in particular practices that we find superior, we say, not only was that a better choice, but I am better. I am better. Or think about work. I was sitting on Friday morning having coffee with a friend, and he said, I'm sort of making an idol out of my work. We were talking about it, and he said, you know, I got up really early this morning, and I sent an email to my boss, and that timestamp said like 6:15, and I felt tremendously good about, he's going to see that. He's going to know that I was up really early. And it was not I am up early. I'm diligent in my work. That's a good thing. The more we talked about it, he was saying, I am better. I have value, significance, worth. I have a moral category attached to this thing of peace. Now, it's an obnoxious thing as a pastor to be having breakfast with someone going, tell me more about that. You know, I've got a sermon coming up here on just this thing here. We do this with all kinds of things. Bible reading streaks, several days in a row. Prayer consistency, quiet time, productivity. And your heart can slowly whisper to you, yeah, Christ saved me, but I maintain myself. I maintain. I hold the markers of the maintenance and security. And when failure comes, because it often does, it always does, the question reveals everything. Well, was it Christ alone that I was leaning on? Or do I simply promise to do what? try harder next time. Other cisterns that we build out for ourselves are our identity. Not only the things we do, but things we're associated with. I am in the right camp. And therefore, I have peace. It's not just the camp that is better. I'm a part of this church, and this is a really good church, and we have particular doctrines that we hold fast to. It's what this Reformed Distinctives class has been all about. And we focus on it, and we don't just say, well, this is better, but we gradually shift over and see that our unity here makes us better. I'm better because of sexual restraint or political identity or cultural positioning. And respectability becomes a form of my own righteousness. Perhaps it's even an identity of suffering. We can do that. Pride can turn anything into an idol. I've suffered more than anyone in this congregation. They don't know my background, my history, the things I go through, the day-to-day. I hear all these prayers, and you begin to say, that's where I see my identity. It's where I rest. I suffered more, therefore I am superior. Or I am on the right side of this equation gives me assurance. Sometimes it shows up not as pride, but as fear, where this perhaps becomes more illuminating to us, and not on the subtle things that we stand on in our pride, but the things that when we absolutely get wrecked, so your schedule gets wiped out. You ever had you have days like that? Someone comes into your office, you get a phone call, you blow a tire, and all of a sudden the tire calendar is just, I've done nothing today, I've got nothing to show for myself, and there's just this welling sense of anxiety that things didn't get done. Moms, you got that? Endless laundry, you got a end of the day, you've burned everything out, and you got a sink full of dishes. Men, your calendar, things to show for yourself, you didn't wake up, exercise, whatever it is, it trashes our peace. And that's the sign. Where does your heart run then? This text is all about your heart needs to be strengthened. Your heart needs to be established. The heart needs a steadiness. And yet we find day to day that the heart is a bit fickle. And so it tries to make this little substitute cistern that holds things. And then it goes to take that big drink from that cistern, that productivity, that being in the camp, that doing everything right, that sending that early email. And it goes to take the drink and goes, there's nothing here. And it's an empty thing. So these are the bit of the diagnostic moments where we kind of pry into our own lives. There's thousands of these that you could draw out for yourself. But what do I instinctively reach for when I'm spiritually insecure? And again, hear me. So a lot of those practices are very good practice. Hear me carefully. It doesn't just go that is a good thing, but that makes me good. What if taken away from you would make you feel exposed? What steadies you when you fail? What reassures your conscience? What convinces you right now that God's pleased with you? It should be a pretty short list. But for many of us, it's quite long. What assures you that God is at peace with you? Is pleased with you? Grace teaches us to rest. It's a very hard lesson. That's a very continual lesson. But grace's instruction is to rest. We often try to self-medicate that restlessness instead of letting grace strengthen our heart. So our generation has its own sort of strange doctrines. We distrust institutions, and then we idolize influencers. We question church and elders while giving uncritical loyalty to podcasters, online voices. We reject ancient wisdom and listen to people who have unaccountable authority. But beneath all that quiet hypocrisy, many believers are carrying that facade around. They try to become holy without Christ. And that's not maturity. That is hypocrisy. So Hebrews is exposing this reality that the cisterns always leak. So why can only Christ stabilize the heart? Well, we are kind of going back to that was an anchor in this text in 13, verse 8. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Now, I've already preached that sermon, but it leads into what we're talking about today. An unchanging Christ means that you do not need constantly changing strategies. When Christ feels insufficient, novelty begins to come up in your mind as a necessity. But when Christ is steady, when Christ is seen for his eternal nature, when he is palpably held on to, the heart can rest. And grace attaches us to that. We need grace. Grace does not assist Christ. Grace replaces every other competitor to Christ. So Scripture describes this as being strengthened in the inner man. So you might feel weak externally. You might lack control over certain circumstances that happen, and the dishes do pile up, and the laundry does break, and your calendar does get all sort of out of whack, and things happen. But the inward stability comes not from structures that we build and we hold on to that reassure us. It comes from grace rooted in an unchanging Christ. And if grace establishes the heart, the question becomes practical. Where do we get that grace? Where do we meet that grace? So the text says, strengthen your heart by grace. How? How do we do it? Well, we do it in an altar that isn't made by human hands. Look at the next verse. We have an altar from which those who serve the tent have no right to eat. Every religious system asks something from you. It's a performance, a bit of a payment, a contribution, a proof. But Christ has an altar where everything was given to you. You do not approach Christ through discipline or ritual or morality or self-improvement. You approach the throne of God through the person, through the mediator, through Christ himself. And so by altar, I mean Christ. He is the ordinary means that strengthens us through his appointed means, through the preaching of the word, through partaking of the sacraments, and by prayer. Why were the priests in this text unable to eat from this altar? Why does it say the priests couldn't go out there? It's because they kept on returning to the old system. The priests had this, metaphorically, the way he's using this phrase is the priests have these food laws, they have this sacrificial system, it's in the tabernacle, and as long as they stay there in that cistern trying to drink from it, they will be empty. They preferred the structure of the shadows versus the substance. And they kept going back to the temple instead of coming to the source. And Christ was crucified, it says, outside of the camp. And you got to go there to him. You got to drink from the fountain, not the cistern. You got to leave that. You got to go to him alone. So we often keep in our practices little membership cards to old altars or substitutional altars, supplemental altars, while claiming Christ. We carry around broken containers, performance, identity, reputation, and we keep trying to kind of fill those things in. So Hebrews forces the question. He says, you need to be strengthened by grace, not food. How do you eat grace? What I mean is, like, how do you tangibly take in that grace? Well, you eat grace by faith. Now, let me admit something to you. It might have just happened to you hearing me say it. It happened to me writing this. I go, here are these tangible things, and you're wrestling with them, and I get it. I get wanting a tangible thing to just say, I ate this food, and I feel better with God. I did this quiet time. I feel better with God, and now you're telling me this comes by faith, and I feel so intangible and weak. Oh, it's so intentional to strip out of your hands the frailty of those hands and to put it in the sufficiency of God's hands. Become empty-handed. You abandon all other altars. You stop bringing contributions and you start receiving mercy. To cling to a system as necessary is to confess that Christ is insufficient. So on the Day of Atonement, he's using a bit of language here that was a bit of insider knowledge. On the Day of Atonement, the remains of the sacrifice were burned outside the camp. There were times when the priests could partake in the sacrifice. They could eat it. That was part of their portion. But on the Day of Atonement, the sacrifice was completely burned outside the camp. And kind of what it's saying here is that out there is nothing for you to eat but grace. Out there with Christ, there's not a meal that you go to kind of work in your tangibility. Out there is only him. Everything's been burned up, and the only thing that remains is his sacrifice. That is it. It gives us our stability. You can't even try to eat it because the only thing that's there is forgiveness. The only thing that's there is mercy. The only thing that's there is him. He does not offer better systems. He offers a better fountain, and the fountain flows with blood. What actually makes you clean? Look with me at the text. So Jesus also suffered outside the gate in order to sanctify the people through his own blood. It's a definitive cleansing. It's not moral progress first. It's not these kind of behavioral improvement. But it's blood before obedience. You're not made clean by the things that you avoid doing. You're made clean by what Christ has done and what he has endured. And so two altars in this metaphorical picture stand side by side. One is endless. You have to feed it. You have to keep nurturing it. It's a cistern that always is bled dry and empty. And you have to do more effort, always more sacrifice. The other altar is finished. Christ's blood is shed. Nothing remains to be added. Move assurance away from yourself and anchor it to the cross. That has been the echo of Hebrews through 13 chapters. If your confidence rises and falls with your performance, you will be standing at the wrong altar. You hear me say that again? If your confidence rises and falls, it's perhaps a warning sign that you are participating in the wrong altar. I'm not saying this is a categorical moral judgment of your life, that you're not saved. It's just saying, warning light, strengthen your heart by grace. It's a constant temptation to feel that frailty and want to say, where could I stand for some sort of tangible stability? And the scriptures say, strengthen your heart by grace. So let's get there. How do we do that? Let's talk first about the cost of following Christ outside the camp. It says in the text, therefore, let us go to him outside the camp and bear the reproach that he endured. It's costly discipleship. Outside the camp is not a call to leave Christ's church. It's not what it's saying. It's a call to leave any old confidences and any self-made altar. The camp that he's talking about is sort of this feeling of belonging or feeling of that quick stability, that cistern that's, you know, that you're holding, but it's without truth. It's acceptance without sacrifice. And today it can be all kinds of things. It's those camps that we were talking about of, I'm in with the right people. I eat the right things. I do the right things. I have moral superiority in those things. It's therapeutic spirituality. It's political belonging. And for us Protestants, it's kind of Catholic. It's needing a relic to give you some sort of stability. And it's not a shrine to, you know, Lady of Guadalupe. It's a calendar. It's a sink of empty dishes. But it can be a similar feeling. If I go there to get my rest, and I go there to get my peace, and I go there to get absolved. The camp offers applause. Christ offers a cross. And yet, Christ was cast out so that sinners could be brought in. The clean one was treated as unclean so that the unclean can be holy. And so following him means leaving comfort. It means leaving that sense of that tangible securities. It means walking away from not only those that are sort of maybe seemingly small or even personal, but even groups of people that would say, you know, hey, you got to be in with our crowd. This is the parameters that we define for what right standing before God looks like. Look, we just go with him alone. He is our sole mediator. It means drinking from a fountain that does not run dry, even if it means I'm running into persecution, I'm running into cultural awkwardness, or I'm running away from my peers, young ones, or I'm running away from other adults, or I'm running to a small church that is faithful over a giant church that is not. Whatever that means, it means I've got to get to him alone, where this preaching of grace is sufficient to stabilize my heart. It's what Paul was talking about this morning, when I need these kinds of things. Because the practical outworking is that my soul is in jeopardy. And Christ's gospel is sufficient to bring a buoyancy to our life and a peace to our life. So what grace produces is love and worship. Good morning. Through him, then, let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise. Notice the order. Through him. How do we worship? It starts with him. It's to him. It's for him, and it's through him. It ends with him. It's not instead of him. Praise is not the price of grace. It's the product. And worship begins to take the unstable heart and the fickle heart and the thing that wants the tangibility to hold on to. It takes the disappointment at the sink and the laundry and the calendar, and it takes the disappointment at the computer screen where you want to lust. It takes all of the things in life that you want to hold on to give yourself a sense of vitality and security, and it realigns your heart and it stabilizes your perspective. Worship is where we see grace. Worship is where you see grace. Worship is where we comprehend and feel the gravity of grace. Worship is where the hunger pains begin to subside because we drink in all of this fountain that we have in Christ. It's a deep draft of all of his goodness. So you can eat well with gratitude. You can eat anything you want with gratitude. Gratitude sort of sanctifies and disinfects all the bad, you know, the bad things. Let me say that sort of in this way. If you, you know, committed to healthy food, praise God, that's great. Don't make it an idol. So today, when we're at lunch, and Paul does his typical move where he goes to the freezer and gets that bowl and fills it up with ice cream bars. If that's you, we're like, eating trans fats, you're like, it's not only a bad idea, it's like, I can't believe I did that. Then Lord bless you today. Walk up to that bowl and in full confidence, hold it for us to see and declare that you are fine with God. But do it in peace. The truth is that that sounds untangible and ethereal. It's not. When the sink is full of dishes and the laundry's piling up and the counter gets wrecked, worship is that tangible thing that you do. Worship is the tangible thing that you do. We can often think of worship as like it's a dedicated space and time, or that we would be to miss the importance and the frequency of worship if we think it's just a dedicated time. If we think just this is worship or just singing is worship. Text says we are to continually offer up a sacrifice of praise. Notice the language. What is the sacrifice here? Was it the food? The text flips it. It says, what's the real sacrifice? It's kind of what Paul preached last time from Romans 12. The real sacrifice is praise. Worship in the nervousness. Worship in the fear. Worship in the pride. I had a really good line, but it only works written and not when you say, I had worship turns wine, W-H-I-N-E, into wine, W-I-N-E. Wouldn't work if I said it. So we might also not grasp the potency of worship. So why do we run after these novelties, these cisterns that can hold no water? It's because we aren't settled with the sufficiency of Christ. We don't see it. So do we worship? Then when we're feeling thin, what's one of the first things to go, if we're honest? Feeling the nervousness, it's one of the first things that we get rid of, worship. When you get the alarm clock fails to go off and you've got to get somewhere fast and you're already starting the day off and just a terrible foot and you're running out the door, there's a couple of things that you are guaranteed to do, even though you're way behind, that you are going to do those things before you let another person physically see you. But often it's not prayer. I want to do my hair. I got to throw some makeup on. There's these things I just have to do. Now, that can be a little close to a legalism, but what I mean by that is how weighty is it? I can't go into this at all unless I've touched God, seen the grace. Otherwise, my whole day is going to be about what happened to me about getting off. God is seeking worshipers. And grace also produces this outward fruit. Look at verse 16. Do not neglect to do good and to share what you have. So good works are not a repayment, they're an overflow. Christ redeemed us to be a people zealous for good works, not to earn salvation, but because salvation was secured. And so this answers a critical question. What makes conduct real instead of hypocritical? It's faith. It's faith. How we do it. Without faith, obedience becomes just another performance. Without faith, generosity becomes image management. Without faith, love becomes some sort of self-justification. But when actions flow from a heart established by grace, when it's done in worship, it all gets sanctified. I mean, worship is not a peripheral thing here. I'm saying worship is central to the Christian. God is seeking worshipers to worship, and he is making us into worshipers. As it turns out, worship realigns and gives us a stable heart. You don't need a better diet. You don't need stricter routines. You don't need more impressive discipline. You need a better Savior, and we already have Him. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He's enough for the weakness that we carry around with us every day. He's enough for the guilt that we sometimes feel. And He's enough for our obedience. We need not seek any stability anywhere else. When those things come, we worship through it. How He's made us. What He's done. Where we are in our life. Praise God for that sink full of dishes. It represents a house full of people. And it represents money to buy that food. It represents a job that you had. It represents a ton of grace. It's just grace after grace after grace. And grace takes all of that and it just freights it with, oh, this is okay. And that was silly. And the heart is established. The heart is strengthened by worship. So don't miss the call to frequency. Always offer up praise to God. Earlier in Hebrews, we were told that He will never leave us and never forsake us. And because He doesn't change, we can endure any hard season. You can obey difficult commands. You can bear the reproach of going out of the camp. Because grace will not fail you. That's what faith is. It's you know, to use John Piper's famous phrase, faith is banking on God's future grace. He will be there in the future. He will always be there. So stop carrying leaky cisterns. Stop digging holes that cannot hold water and come to the fountain. And drink deeply in worship and be established, worshiping continually. And go outside the camp. Run away from those things that say, stay here and find your stability and comfort. Run to Him outside the camp. There's nothing there for you but grace. There's nothing there but you, for you, but everything. There's nothing there for you but everything, because that's where He is. Offer your life, not to earn His love, but because you've already